unpack this passage tonight and this idea, this chapter tonight, that you would speak to us, speak directly to our hearts. Anything that's not of you that I say, I pray, would be forgotten, and we would hold dear to the things that you want us to hear. Amen. Right. So, as Martin said earlier on, we're continuing our series on God is Stranger, which is Gideon and the Stranger, the God who turns up way too late. And we've been doing Alpha at the 10:45 service, and in the first session we were asked, what would you ask God? If you could ask him one question, what would you ask? And I thought long and hard about what kind of question I would ask. And in the end, the one I came up with, and this isn't rigged with what I'm talking about tonight, but it's, why do you take so long to come? Why did you take so long to intervene after everything went wrong? And why, you know, and I think there's possibly a bit of present tense there. You know, why does it sometimes feel like God takes ages to show up? Because I think, you know, we all have times in our lives where we feel like God has kept us waiting. Is he even going to show up at all? I mean, you know, we've just heard Pauline share about John's sister, and, you know, we've been doing it for 30 years. And you know, you get to that point where you think, you know, are you going to do anything, God? Come on, you know. And so we're going to look at the call of Gideon, in particular that initial conversation he has with the Lord, and see what we can learn from it and apply it to our lives. And hopefully we can be challenged and also encouraged. Now, I have to admit, my first impression of Gideon is that he's a bit wet and he's a bit of a wimp. I'm not going to lie. I said this to Mum when I first started preparing the talk. She said, "You can't say that." And I said, and I didn't read this through to her beforehand, and this is probably why, so I can say it. I think Gideon's a bit of a wimp. You know, he seems a bit sort of quivery and, oh dear, oh, you know, wet my fleece, dry my fleece. And he describes himself by his own admission as being the least of his clan. And that could mean he's the youngest, but it could just mean he was a bit of a weakling. And I wonder whether he was maybe a bit of a mummy's boy. You know, if he was maybe a bit weak, you know, perhaps he had a weak chest, and maybe he wasn't allowed to play with his brothers, you know, like with the rough and tumble, you know. And maybe he clung onto his mother's apron strings a bit. I don't know, but he seems to be, comes across as really wet, you know, and a bit of a wimp. And when he comes face to face with God and he's commissioned to lead the Israelites to defeat their oppressors, the Midianites, he keeps asking God for signs. And he's not content with being told, "I will be with you, I am sending you." You know, and then his offering goes up in flames. And then, you know, he starts faffing around with fleeces, asking for them to be wetted or dried. And you just think, oh, come on, Gideon. In fact, in Krish Kandaya's chapters, it's a bit of an aside, in the chapter Krish Kandaya wrote, he said lots of people sort of take it literally that we can do what Gideon did and lay out a fleece. And he said of an Albanian man who once, you know, took a fleece out and laid it out overnight, having sort of asked God a particular question. And he went out very eagerly in the morning to see what awaited him, and his fleece had gone. So that's the thing, it doesn't work every time, apparently. And I have to be honest, you know, I think if I was God, I'd be telling Gideon to man up. I'd be like, come along, pull yourself together, let's go. Chop, chop, time to go. No, leave that fleece alone. Come along. And I feel, you know, that Gideon is pandered to by God in sort of like all the signs he gets. You know, I sort of think, you know, I'd love it if the angel of the Lord came, or the Lord came and spoke to me face to face and said, "I'd like you to go and do this." And in my head, I think, oh, I'd just go and do it. But I don't know, maybe I'll be a bit more like Gideon and start asking for signs. I haven't been asked to go and defeat an army, so I can't, you know, speak for what I'd actually do. But I think if we look a little bit deeper into the history of the Israelites and the initial conversation God has with Gideon, I think we see a bit of a different picture, and it's maybe a bit more accurate than my interpretation of Gideon being wet. So firstly, we've got to understand the history of the Israelites. And they seem to go in a very repetitive cycle, round and round and round. It starts with them being called by God, and then they sin. They don't do as God instructs them to. And because they're sinning and they're not following instructions, they end up getting oppressed and there's several nations and armies and groups that come and oppress them each time, and then they cry out to God, and God comes and rescues them, and then they praise him and say, oh, you're so wonderful, great, we won't do it again. And then the cycle repeats itself. They sin, and then they're oppressed, and then they cry out to God, and he rescues them, and then they praise him and say, you're so wonderful, we're not going to do it again. And then they do, and it just goes on and on and on, round and round and round in a circle. And at this point, they've been in the hands of the Midianites for 7 years. And that's quite a long time, 7 years. And it's been a very wearing and challenging 7 years. They're at the point of desperation. And it says earlier in the chapter that they took to hiding out in caves and clefts of mountains. You know, they were refugees in their own country. And their food had been raided, their animals were taken, and they were literally at the point of having nothing. And it explains clearly in the first few verses that God handed the Israelites over to the Midianites. Now, that sounds really harsh and cruel, but it's because the Israelites weren't listening to God, and they weren't following his instructions. And he couldn't really do anything with them because of that. And they weren't in the right place to overcome their enemies. And there are consequences to sin. And God allows them to be oppressed because they aren't ready to follow him and his instructions. He can't do much with them until they are. And when we first meet Gideon, he's threshing wheat in a wine press, which shows a certain level of desperation. He's wanting to avoid the Midianites getting it. It's a bit like being at school and eating your lunch in the toilet to stop the bullies from getting it. And I did a bit of research on wheat threshing and wine pressing this week to try and sort of understand this picture a bit more. And basically, wheat threshing needed to be done in a wide open space because they sort of tossed the wheat into the air to separate out all the different parts. And it talks, you know, you often get references to things being done on the threshing floor. I think it's Boaz and Ruth goes and seduces Boaz on the threshing floor, for want of a better word. And it's a wide open space. Whereas the wine press is a tiny hole in the ground. So he's trying to do a job that needs to be done in a big open space in a tiny hole in the ground. You can sort of imagine him sort of tossing maybe doing it with a spoon or something, I don't know, sort of tossing the wheat up in the air and trying to get the process to happen, but it's probably not working very well. I mean, just imagine trying to cook a roast dinner on a one-ring camping stove in your back garden. You know, the tool doesn't quite match the task. But it gives us a clue to Gideon's desperation, and it also shows us he's quite resourceful. Desperation can drive people to all sorts of things, but Gideon shows a real resourceful flair. He may be weak and not necessarily very physically strong, but mentally he's all there. So not necessarily the wimp I had him down for. And when the angel of the Lord appears to Gideon, he greets him with, "The Lord is with you, mighty warrior." And the Lord is with you was a customary greeting back then. And it had a response, which was, "The Lord bless you." So just like when we're sharing communion, we sometimes share the peace. You know, if one person says, "Peace be with you," the other person replies, "Excellent." Bit of audience participation there. Keep you awake. So calling Gideon a mighty warrior certainly grabbed his attention. And it was quite provocative, because Gideon wasn't really a mighty warrior, and certainly not in his own strength. And he was the first person to admit that. So if we were to be sharing the peace, imagine if one of you came up to me and said, "Peace be with you, Olympic athlete." And at this point, I probably wouldn't just respond with, "And also with you." I'd probably go, "What?" You know, and I said at the 9 o'clock service, you know, I never say never with God anymore, because, you know, you never could know quite what God's going to do. But it's very, very, very unlikely for me to become an Olympic athlete anytime soon. So I'd probably be very shocked if anyone said that to me. But it would certainly make me take notice of you if you'd asked me that, and I'd wonder what on earth was going through your head at that time to call me an Olympic athlete. And Gideon, when he gets called, you know, peace is, the Lord be with you, mighty warrior, he doesn't do the polite response of, you know, the Lord bless you. At this point, Gideon's frustrations boil over. And this is what he says in verse 13, and I think I've got a slightly different version to the one read out. But he says, "Pardon me, my Lord," Gideon replied, "but if the Lord is with us, why has all this happened to us? Where are all his wonders that our ancestors told us about when they said, 'Did not the Lord bring us up out of Egypt?' But now the Lord has abandoned us and given us to the hand of Midian." And this person is a stranger. You know, it's like, you know, when you go to Tesco's and they always say, "Oh, good morning, how are you today?" And you know, it's not really the best etiquette to say, "Oh, well, I'm having terrible jitter in my hip, and all the cats had terrible fur balls, and oh, I don't know what I'm going to do about my ceiling, it's terribly case coming in and the water's coming in." You know, you're just supposed to reply with, "Fine, thank you." Doesn't matter if your head's hanging off, you know, you just have to say, "Great, fine, thank you." That's all you're supposed to say. And because they're a stranger, you don't know them, and Gideon, this person's a stranger, and he's just ranted at them. He's just poured forth all his troubles. And on reading, it could be read fairly politely, but we don't know the intonation. He does say, "My Lord," or "Sir," I think we had in the NIV version. But sometimes a certain amount of venom can be injected into things. So, you know, for example, you could say, "All right, mate." And the same sentence could be said, "All right, mate." It's the same sentence, but it's said two very different ways. And I sort of sense a bit of passive aggressiveness in Gideon's response. He may be being polite, but I think there could be a bit of a, "Pardon me, my Lord, but..." And I think his tone's rather bitter because he feels abandoned by God. The God who his ancestors have told him all about hasn't shown up for him. And he feels let down. During my teaching career, right from going on placements to having my own classes, I've taught a wide range of children. And there's a few that stand out in my mind from having had very difficult lives, very turbulent lives. And there was one child in particular that in their 7 years of life had a very difficult time. And as a result, they were really, really hardened. And it was just so sad to see how disillusioned this child had become. And they'd been let down so many times by the adults in their life that they took a long time to trust anyone new. And, you know, because most children at that age, they blindly believe that all grown-ups are good and want to help you. But this child certainly didn't believe that, and it took a long time for me to get them to trust me. And in the first few weeks and months of working with that class, with that child in, that child was constantly testing me to see if I was going to let them down or not. Things like if, for example, our timetable changed, as it sometimes did, you know, for things like, so if we said, "Oh, we're going to do science this afternoon," and then I'd go and get the science resources and find that... you know, another teacher had got them and said, "Oh, I'm halfway through an experiment, you know, can you do it tomorrow?" And I'd say, "That's fine, we'll do geography instead, I don't know." And all the other children would be fine with that. They'd just go, "Oh, okay, that's fine." And I said, "We'll do it tomorrow." They were perfectly happy with that. And this child would sort of be like, but you said we were going to do that. You know, I was sort of questioning, going back on my word, essentially. And everything we did was met with a why. You know, why are we going outside? Why are we having playtime? Why are we doing this? And, you know, why aren't we back inside yet? You know, and I say, "We're going in 5 minutes," and then 5 minutes. "You said we were going in 5 minutes. It's now 5 minutes." And everything was questioned. Everything was challenged. And this is what we see Gideon doing. He's tentatively seeing if he can trust God. And for someone who felt let down and abandoned by God, God was showing Gideon who he was, that he was to be trusted, that he would deliver Israel and he would keep his promises. And in the same way, I put extra effort into answering the why of that particular child in my class. I was laying the groundwork for them to trust me. God does the same with Gideon. He puts that extra effort in, so he goes and wets his fleece, he goes and dries the fleece, he puts that extra effort in to showing Gideon that yes, you can trust me. And if we read Exodus 13, when the Israelites come out of Egypt, God told them to consecrate the firstborn males, and part of that was about telling the firstborn male, in each family about how God rescued them and brought them out of Egypt. And the idea was is that that rescue was to be remembered. The faithfulness of God was to be held on to and remembered. And you know, he said, tell the firstborn son, and then that firstborn son would tell his firstborn son, and then he would tell his firstborn son. It was to pass down through the generations. And the reason is that they weren't going to cross the Red Sea every single day of their lives. And, you know, we may only have one or two Red Sea crossing moments in our lives. But it's remembering those moments that sustains us in the desert. And that's what God wanted for the Israelites. It's like, hold on to that memory of my faithfulness to you. Hold on to that story, that testimony, because it will sustain you. It will keep you going in the desert times. And that's what testimony does. That's why it's so great when we stand up and share about, you know, God putting the exact right number of donuts on the shelf, or God making the path straight, and sharing those moments, because it sustains us, it keeps us going, it raises our faith. And this is why God tells the Israelites, he's encouraging them, pass it on, keep it alive, remember this moment to help you keep your faith sustained in the difficult times. Because here, when we see at this moment, the Israelites, they're kind of in a dark place. Their faith is really, really wavering. And Gideon knew the stories. He'd heard the stories. But for him, that's all they were. They were stories. And there comes a point that without relationship with God, the testimony just becomes a story. It loses its value and its meaning. It loses the nutrition which sustains us. And you may want to turn to John 11, because I'm going to refer to this story. It's the story of Lazarus being raised from the dead, and it's on page 1078 in your pew Bibles. And in this story, we have Mary and Martha, who we've met, the same Mary and Martha where Jesus goes to tea at their house, and their brother Lazarus has died. And when Jesus is told that Lazarus is really sick, upon hearing this news, he doesn't get up and rush straight there. He doesn't drop all he's doing. He stays put where he is for another 2 days. And when he arrives, it's pointed out 3 times, once by Mary, once by Martha, and once by somebody else. It's pointed out 3 times, if you had been here, this wouldn't have happened. And again, we've got this image of God turning up late. Jesus seemed to turn up way too late to do anything. Yet we see a very different response from Mary and Martha than we do from Gideon. Whereas Gideon was really cutting in his response and very bitter and very angry, he's very, very guarded. We see Mary and Martha very, very differently. They could have said to Jesus, well, what's the point in, you know, you've turned up too late, go away, there's no point you being here. But they don't. They go and meet him, and they go and they weep. It says, you know, when Martha heard that Jesus was coming, verse 20, she went out to meet him. But Mary stayed at home, but she comes along later on. Lord, Martha said to Jesus, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But I know that even now God will give you whatever you ask. And again, we see with Mary. Mary reached the place where Jesus was and saw him. She fell at his feet and said, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. When Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who had come along with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and troubled. Where have you laid him? He asked. Come and see, Lord, they replied. Jesus wept. And you know, Mary and Martha both come to Jesus in their raw pain and emotions. They're much freer with them. And actually, when you trust somebody, you're prepared to be vulnerable before them. You're prepared to maybe let your emotions show. And we can tell from this that Mary and Martha trust Jesus. And the reason why is because he's their friend. He's been to their house for tea. They know him. They know who he is, and they know what he has the power to do. Martha said to him, even now, God would give you whatever you ask. She knows he's the Christ. And actually, I think the key difference between Gideon and Mary and Martha is their relationship with God, with Jesus. That's the difference. And you know, in verse 35, Jesus wept, shortest verse in the Bible. And actually, he weeps for us too, not just Mary and Martha. He weeps for us in the situations of hopelessness, where we feel like God isn't showing up, where it doesn't feel like he's turning up in our situations, when we're hurting, when we're despairing. He weeps with us. He's moved in the same way he's moved by Mary and Martha's upset. He's moved when we're upset. He feels our pain. He doesn't belittle it. And actually, he knew he was going to raise Lazarus. He said before, in earlier in chapter 11, he says, let's go and wake Lazarus up. He's referring to say, look, I'm going to go and raise him from the dead. He knew what he was going to do. But he didn't turn up and say to Mary and Martha, oh, no, never mind, stop crying, dry your eyes, let's go and sort this out. He weeps with them. And he does the same with us, even when he knows, we don't know necessarily how situations are going to work out, but he knows. But he still weeps with us in that moment, in that pain. And I think, you know, we can say to God when things are difficult, when we can say to God when things aren't going how we think they ought to, when it feels like he's not showing up or he's late, we can say to God, you know, why aren't you doing this? We can, because he's our Father, and it's important to have that relationship with him where we can take that to him, and he's big enough to do that. It's really, really important to do that. Our relationship with God can hold up, can sustain that. When I was at secondary school, I used to walk to school with my friend. She was my best friend. In fact, I walked to school with my two best friends. And I would walk off first and go call into my friend's house on the way, and then we'd go and call in and collect our other friend, and off we'd go. But my friend, my first friend that I would collect, was terribly disorganised. And when I got to her door in the morning, I was usually invited to come in, and I would spend a large portion of time standing in her hallway waiting for her to get ready. I think occasionally she was ready to walk out the door, and I used to sort of keel over in shock when she did, because she was never ready. You know, sometimes she, you know, hadn't got her books ready, and she'd say, what have we got today? And I'd sort of have to reel off the timetable, and sometimes she hadn't finished her breakfast, and sometimes she hadn't done her makeup or whatever it was, you know. And so I spent quite a large time standing in her hallway. It could be anything from 5 minutes to 25 minutes. And that was every morning. And we worked out once. I said to her in a lesson when we probably should have been doing some work, I said to her, you know, do you realise how long I've probably spent waiting for you? And we worked it out. We did a very tentative average of 10 minutes a day, and we did, you know, 39 weeks of school in the year and 5 days a week. And we worked out that over 5 years, I spent 162 and a half hours waiting for her. And that equates to about 6.7 days of my life waiting for my friend. What could I have done in those 6.7 days? I probably could have taken an extra GCSE. But you know, and so I spent a long time in those four walls waiting for her to get ready. But you know what? In that 5 years, never once did I say, I'll meet you at school, and leave her behind. I always, always waited. And the reason why is because she was my friend. It wasn't some random person that I had to wait for. If it was a random person, I probably would have given up on day two and made my own way. But I always waited for my friend because she was my friend. We had a relationship. And when we have a relationship with God, we know that he wants what's best for us, and we're prepared to wait. Because we know he's got a plan. And sometimes that waiting is difficult. I'm not saying it isn't really challenging waiting sometimes. But when we know we have that relationship with him, we know we can hold on. It's a bit like a child when they clamour for a biscuit. And the parent says no, because they know they've got a really nutritious meal in the oven, which they're going to serve up in about half an hour. And small children just have no, they just want the biscuit. I want the biscuit now, give it to me now. And they just can't, you know, we're having dinner soon, but it's not now. The child wants it now. And that's what we're like, is now, God, give me this now, give it now. Not, you know, come and do this, come into this situation. And God's saying, just hold on, there's something in the oven. Hold on. And because God is our loving Heavenly Father, He wants to give us good things. He wants to come into our situations. And I could have done a whole other talk about God's waiting time and what He does with us in the waiting. But His timing is always perfect. And there was a song by a guy called Scott Underwood that we sung one year at New Wine. And it was called Perfect Timing. And there was a line in it that said this. It said, "We may wait, but you're never late." And that's great because, we do wait sometimes. We wait a lot of the time. But God is never late. And He uses the waiting time. And at the end of his chapter on Gideon and the stranger, Krish Kandaya said this. "Sometimes God makes himself a stranger because he wants to give us a genuine choice as to whether or not we will put him first." And that's what we see with the Israelites. He gives them the choice. He's a God of free will, and we got given free will, and we're allowed to use it. And to Gideon, God was that. He was a stranger. He was somebody he'd heard of, but he had no relationship with him. And he had to learn to trust God, just like that child I taught. I was once a stranger to them, but over time I built a relationship with them, and they learned to trust me. And to Mary and Martha, they had that trust in Jesus because he was their friend. And being in a relationship with Jesus doesn't mean that we never have to wait again. But the wait becomes more bearable because we know his faithfulness. And we hold on to it in the desert times. Why don't you stand and let's pray.